Well, we have tropical storms we can talk about. We can talk about giant dust plumes. We can talk about world record-breaking lightning flashes. Oh, my. We have a lot to catch up on in the world of weather. And we've got just the experts to help us out. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today. We have one expert with us right now of our weather guys, Steve Ackerman, Vice Chancellor for Research and Graduate Education at UW-Madison, also a professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. A bit later on, John Martin will join us, professor and former chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. So we're going to talk about all these odd weather events we've been hearing about lately, whether all those 80-degree days we've been having are out of character or not, and a whole lot more. And I hope you'll join in with your own weather questions and observations. You can call us at 800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. And what have you noticed about the weather around you lately? Love to hear from you. And Steve Ackerman, welcome.
Hey, Larry. How you doing?
Well, I guess I'm doing just fine here.
Yes, it is. It has been a very interesting June weather between the tropical storm being influenced by a hurricane weather and then a Saharan aerosol layer off the Saharan Desert. I mean, it's just been a very interesting June.
It has indeed, and I know we're going to get to all that, but I know the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, as it's called, it's renewed its partnership with UW-Madison for 5 years. What does that mean for the university and for you guys?
It's great for the university, and it's great for NOAA. This partnership is the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies, which first began in July of 1980. And so every 5 years now, there's a renewal process and a competition so that other universities can compete if they want to try and move this expertise to a different university. And that expertise is all about satellite observations of the weather and using those satellites to improve weather forecasting, and also to help design the next generation weather satellites and their applications. So it's great news. There's a great group there. I used to be the director of that institute, but stepped down when I got this new job. Tristan LeCure is now the new director and doing a great job.
Oh, man. Well, yeah, from the frying pan to the fire a little bit there for you.
Sure was.
Oh, my goodness me. Well, I tell you what, we won't talk about that now. Let's go to Mo and O'Connell and talk to Mo and see what's on Mo's mind. Hi, Mo. Thanks for calling.
Hello. My question is kind of twofold. One is there a way to predict when we have these huge downpours like we had in western Wisconsin? And is there any kind of website to see it? I mean, were these people you saying, hey, you're going to be flooded out with this rainstorm tomorrow, something like that? And is there any websites to go on to kind of see what the season prediction is going to be?
Yeah, you know, with the season prediction, there is a site called the Midwestern Regional Climate Center, and they primarily focus on the weather that has recently happened over the last week, in the last month, and over the season. But they also then have links to other NOAA sites to look at what the predictions, what the outlooks are for the particularly the coming season on the climate scale. I think for the precipitation forecast for western Wisconsin, I would look at the NOAA La Crosse Weather Forecasting Office. I'll bet that they have some good links and talk about the upcoming forecast. those heavy rains were predicted pretty well over the last month or so. In fact, it's been getting pretty good at both temperature and precipitation forecasts. And then also, you know, I can't underestimate or understate the importance of the local forecasters for each region. You know, the private companies, they all do a really good job as well. And they leverage a lot of the information that's provided by the National Weather Service and by NOAA.
So there you go, Mo. Thank you so much for that question. Tom in Delavan has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Tom.
Hi there. 70 years ago, I saw my first jet. I'm 76 years old. And the vapor trail, as we know, was very, very short. Today, as we know, the vapor trails are usually very long and can take minutes to disappear. All of that's obviously happening at 30,000 feet. So at least my analysis is the relative humidity at 30,000 feet 70 years ago was almost, i.e., it was dry air. Today, obviously, there's a lot more moisture there. And so how does that moisture move around? What's that story? Does that moisture move, or does it stay there, or what's the story?
All right.
That's a good question, and there's two parts to that, I think. One is that how does the moisture move around? We do know that as the Earth's been warming up, there is more water in the atmosphere, and that water primarily comes from evaporation off the surface, either the oceans, lakes, or transpiration through plants. And so the increase starts down low in the atmosphere. And then atmospheric circulation patterns, thunderstorms, winds in general, will mix that up into the atmosphere. And so that's how it generally gets moved up to the 3,000-foot level where the aircraft fly. It's unclear. Well, I would say that it's a little hard to tell from the contrails what's going on with the moisture in the upper atmosphere. There are radiosondes, which are instruments that carry thermometers and humidity sensors into the upper atmosphere. And we're continually looking at that over time. The concentration is generally pretty small. The thing with the contrails that come out, Tom's pointing out, sometimes they look really long, which means that the upper atmosphere has a high humidity, and so they can stay around and sometimes spread out into cirrus clouds. Sometimes they could be short if it's dry, or also depending on what the wind structure is. And so if it's a circulation pattern, so there's a gentle sinking motion, even if the upper atmosphere is moist, those contrails won't last long. Because the sinking motion will tend to warm them up and dry them out.
There you go, Tom. Thank you so much for calling. I appreciate your call. And let's see, Joanne and Monona, your turn. Hi, Joanne.
Hi. First, I'd like to say thanks for the conversation on the ozone. That was really interesting.
Tracy Holloway did a great job.
Yeah, lots of things I'd never heard before. So,
really good.
My question is, you know, the forecasters tell you how much rain they think is going to fall, but is there a website or an app where I can go to find out how much rain actually did fall?
Oh, yeah. If you want to know what actually did fall, there is a community site. It's called COCARAS. Trying to remember now what it stands for. It's COCORAHS, Community Collaborative Rain, Hail, and Snow. That's a great site because a lot of people, a lot of weather enthusiasts, use their smartphones that when it rains, they have rain gauges out there that are properly sight, and they will go out after the rainstorm and measure them. And I'm recommending them because they usually get a good high density of the daily precipitation that occurred from that community collaborative association. So that's Cocorahs, C-O-C-O-R-A-H-S. And if you Google on that, it ought to be able to pop up. And then I think they also have links to the National Weather Service, which will also provide daily precipitation amounts.
Joanne, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And I believe we've got John Martin with us as well now. He's joining in. I'm sure he has studied his farmer's almanac and is ready with some weather predictions.
You know that I have, Larry. That is correct.
Oh, man. We're going to take a quick look at the news and the weather, and we'll find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network. And then we'll be back with our two guests, good guys, John Martin and Steve Ackerman. Steve, Vice Chancellor for Research and Grad Education at UW-Madison now. John Martin, Professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. Of course, Steve has an appointment there as well. So give a call, 800-642-1234, and we'll be back right after this look at the news. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at weather and climate with our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin, both professors in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Steve Ackerman, also Vice Chancellor for Research and Graduate Education at UW-Madison. Questions about the weather, experiences to share? Hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. And John, it is good to have you join us.
Yeah, thanks, Larry. It's good to be here.
Yeah, great to hear your voice again. I wanted to mention Natalie Guyette shot me a note and said she's posting that cocoraz.org, which is gives us community rainfall information, if I'm right, Steve.
Yes, right, yep. And people can join it. They tell you how to make the measurements and suggest rain gauges, and then you can enter your own precipitation as well.
Okay, and that we'll put that up at WPR.org, so that link, so you can get that if you didn't get it written down earlier. Carrie in Richmond's been waiting a bit, so let's go there. Carrie, hi. Thanks for calling.
Oh, you bet. Thanks for taking my call. So I'm just wondering, in these last 3 months, has the weather changed at all because of COVID with the environment renewing? I understand lakes are getting cleaner, and because, you know, we had the stay-at-home act, that there's a lot less pollution because we hadn't been driving.
So, what do you think?
I will add I'll add to the pollution side, because I know we have seen on satellite measurements. I don't know if Tracy got to talk about this in the previous hour, because there's less traffic, because people are staying home, air quality has improved just because of the shutdown of industry and traffic. Now, how that has affected weather, I'm not sure we've been able to discern that yet. Just because there's so many intercomplex interactions between not just the pollution, but the dynamics of the atmosphere and how it moves around. And we're, you know, in a transition zone now of entering summer as well.
And John, you were going to add something?
Yeah, I was just going to say I definitely agree with that. I think that even the impact on the quality of the environment in terms of pollution and other things like that is fairly small, but certainly it's feedback toward development and propagation intensity of weather systems is probably a very small impact and very hard to measure, as Steve points out, and hard to make any conclusions about it after such a short time.
Yeah, that makes sense. But I'm sure that's going to be something people are looking at. Nick in Green Bay, it's your turn. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Larry. I just got a question for you. Watching a TV show, and of course my kids didn't interrupt me until I couldn't get to the end of it. But I was watching a show. They were saying that the tornadoes are getting stronger every year. And I was just wondering what your hypothesis was of like, when is it going to max out? I mean, I know they're very unpredictable and stuff, but
yeah,
kind of a scary thing.
Yeah, tornadoes are kind of a scary thing for sure. Well, yeah. John, do you want to start?
I think I've got no sense at all yet from the literature or from people who study tornadoes, particularly within our science, that there's been any increase in the intensity in an aggregate sense. That is, that the collection of tornadoes that affect the country, and our country is really ground zero for tornadoes around the world. We're not the only place that gets them, but nobody gets them like we do. But I don't think there's been any report of an increase in the number of F3, F4, and F5, the more intense tornadoes, as compared to 30 or 40 years ago. I'm not aware of that information. And so I would guess that if such a speculation is made now, that it is more or less speculation. These storms are very, very local and come in a variety of intensities, which I think are somewhat independent of a lot of the larger broad-scale changes that are occurring in the climate, at least for the time being.
All right. Thank you so much. Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, I think the only thing I would add is, as John points out, these are very local events. And so when you look over a 30-year time period, the other thing that influences the time series is whether or not they were observed and what was our capability to make observations of tornadoes 30 years ago. And certainly today, with new radars and increased populations of where people are living, it's a lot easier to detect and report tornadoes than what it was 30 years ago.
Betty, thanks for that, Nick. Appreciate it. Betty emailed saying she heard that less air travel affects weather reporting and wonders how that works. What is the impact? What adjustments are you making to forecasting due to less travel?
Well, less air travel means fewer airplanes in the sky, and airplanes are equipped with a lot of sensors that actually feed into our initial conditions for numerical weather prediction models. So with fewer aircraft flying, we do have fewer observations than we had normally had before the pandemic. And whether or not there's been a discernible impact on the accuracy of short and medium range forecasting, I don't know the answer to that. Again, it's probably a function of the short fuse. We're only 3 months in. But it's definitely a factor that if you have fewer aircraft, you have fewer of the observations that we use to initialize these forecast models. But aircraft data does not represent the largest pot of observations. So the impact probably will stay relatively small. Steve can speak to this because satellites are the biggest one.
Yeah. Steve?
Yeah. Yeah, satellites are definitely the biggest ones. I think a couple of months ago, like when the COVID-19 outbreak really started to take hold, there were some theoretical studies of the potential impact of losing those observations. And they demonstrated that it was going to impact some certain types of forecasts. And the way they do that is, and they do this with satellite imagery as well as other observations, is they'll run a sequence of forecasts, assess the accuracy of it, and then they'll do it all again, but they'll pull a particular data set out and see what that impact is with regard to the accuracy in a 3-4 day forecast. And so there were studies like that back in, what seems like forever ago, back in April.
Yeah, no kidding. Deep.
Oh, man. Well, a meteorologist with NOAA has predicted that the average temperatures across the nation are likely to be above normal through September. And we've had a lot of 80-degree temperatures in southern Wisconsin, at least, it seems to me anyway. Are these higher temperatures unusual?
I think with the 80 degree, we had some recent ones. I noticed, although I think the weather for the last month has been glorious because it hasn't been that humid. But if I remember, and John might remember better, didn't it take us a while before we hit our first 80 degree temperature?
Yeah,
it sure did. Yeah, we made a run for the all-time record. We didn't get there until the end of May, somewhere between the 20th and 30th of May, and the all-time record was June 10th. So we were, you know, not that far off. And I was just thinking about this question though today myself. You know, we had in 2013, I think we had 39 days over 90. And I don't think we've had one yet. We may have one during this heat spell now, maybe early next week. But we have had quite a number of days in the mid-80s and with high humidity. But I don't think it's anything particularly unusual, unfortunately, for those of us who like records. We're really not in record territory.
I think May was the end of May. It was tied with May of 2016 for the hottest May on record, globally, that is.
Yeah, that's true. This past May was tied for the hottest global temperature, for sure. And looking out for the next for the summer, NOAA is predicting a high confidence in warmer than normal temperatures for most of the U.S., particularly out west, and then drier as well, which may, you know, bring to mind forest fires and things like that. At least that's what comes to my mind as we go through the summer.
Yeah, for sure. Dave in La Crosse has a question. Dave, hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. I'm wondering about with the locust plague and the dust storm coming out of Africa. There have been reports that they were plowing fields in the Sahel south of the Sahara like every year. That used to be only plowed once every 15 years because the land is so poor. And I was wondering if there is, in fact, a connection like there was in the 1930s of excessive heat resulting from plowing the moisture out of the soil and all the other consequences of that sort of thing.
Yeah, you know, I was just looking at an article this morning, in fact, with a locust outbreak. And I think the one that I was looking at was in India. I don't know if it was occurring in Africa, at least the one that I had read about. But, boy, it just looked really nasty. But that aside, back to your question, there is a theory called desertification. And actually, it was looked at and investigated by Reed Bryson, who is one of the co-founders of our department many years ago. And that theory leads to, on the borders of deserts, if you were to have overgrazing by sheep, so domesticated sheep, that could dry out a region and extend the desert. So there is that theory that it's associated with devegetation extending a desert region into a semi-desert area.
All right, there we go. Thank you, Dave. Vera in Dowsman, Wisconsin, your turn. Hi, Vera.
Hi, how are you?
Good, appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
All right, I'm holding an article from May 9th, 2020. Wisconsin summer is predicted to be colder than usual, and it's by AccuWeather. So I don't know anything about them, but I was very looking forward to the cooler weather because I do not like this hot, humid stuff. And here's one thing. AccuWeather is predicting a chilly June and early July with the possibility that cold, rainy spring we're having will stick around for a little while longer. So what's the deal with this?
Well, they certainly blew that forecast.
Yeah, they did. And AccuWeather was not very accu.
No, they shouldn't be in the business of that. They should not be in the business of these 30 to 60 day forecasts because it does lend an air of authority to what is really not something that's in our wheelhouse at this point in our science. We can't make 30 to 60 day forecasts with that kind of specificity and with that kind of regional accuracy, and yet they're doing it, experimentally or not. It does kind of mislead people into thinking the science has actually progressed to that point. We're not quite there yet, so it's a little bit irresponsible.
Yeah.
All right. There you go, Vera. Thanks. Scott in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Scott.
Afternoon. I'm curious about what the effects for us are going to be of the fires in Siberia, the thawing of the permafrost all the way across the Arctic. How is that going to, what's that going to do to us?
That's a very good question. The fires are one thing. There's going to be aerosol put into the atmosphere. The atmosphere is so enormous, we may not see any of that in terms of a reduction of our air quality or even turbidity, although that's not impossible when we have forest fires. There are big ones up in Western Canada. That certainly has an impact on our sky. The permafrost melting, it's been very warm this year in high-latitude Russia and Siberia. That's not so innocuous because that releases methane that's trapped in this permafrost. It clathrates frozen soil with methane in it, decomposing vegetable matter. And when the methane gets in the atmosphere, it stays for a very long time, and it's a very potent greenhouse gas. So having a lot of it locked up in frozen tundra is a good thing for keeping our climate more like what we're used to. But if it starts to get released by this melting, that's probably not a good thing because it's going to increase the radiative retention of the Earth's atmosphere, keep us a little warmer than we are used to.
Thank you very much for that call. Appreciate your call. Well, we've sort of mentioned the sand that's coming from the Sahara that's in the air. I read an article, I forget where, but we're talking about thousands of tons of sand in the air.
Yeah.
it almost boggles my mind.
I mean, if you watch the satellite imagery as it came off Africa, and these events happen frequently. It's not a, once in a lifetime kind of event. But what is unique is the amount of dust soil that's suspended in this storm. It's been fascinating, I think, to watch some of the post of photographs in the Gulf regions in North Carolina as well. It's just amazing that the air quality going down because of this dust all the way from northern Africa. It's incredible.
Yeah, it is. It is awesome. It's continental scale, and it's fine particulate dust. It's just amazing. Just amazing. And it has an impact on tropical cyclones, as people at he was former leader of SIMS, now it's Tristan Lecuyer, the SIMS hurricane satellite people were the first really to see that the Saharan dust has an impact on hurricanes in the Atlantic Basin. So it's not inconsequential.
So what does it do? Does it lessen or increase hurricanes?
I think it lessens, right, Steve, if I'm right? I think it adds a factor that kind of weakens the storms and makes it more difficult for them to develop, I think.
Yeah, that's what it does. Yeah, it weakens them and reduces the chance of them forming.
And then
it does, there's a wind shear associated with it, too, and that's not good for hurricane formation.
Yeah.
Let's take another call. Jan in Madison, your turn. Hi, Jan.
Oh, hi. Good afternoon. I wanted to just talk to you a little bit about when we built our house in July 43 years ago, and it was close to 100 degrees and very humid in July, and they couldn't put the roof on. Because the roof shingles were melting.
Oh, wow.
So wow.
That's amazing.
That was a long time ago. But the other thing is, I'm sitting in a rainstorm right now behind our business, and I just was looking at the Skywarn network and noticing, I've taken Skywarn classes, and noticing that all of the little cells are blowing up over southwestern Wisconsin and moving into the Madison area. So I would recommend Skywarn network to people who are interested in just finding out a little bit.
Thanks, Jan.
I agree 100%, Jan. I just got off a PhD dissertation meeting at the University of Delaware, where they have a renowned program on emergency management, disaster management. And one of our former University of Wisconsin graduate students just got his PhD looking at the perception of storm spotters in the Skywarn network and how they fit into the integrated warning system. So you guys are doing a great job. And until now, not well understood in terms of how it's been integrated into how we make warnings about severe weather. So hats off to you.
Yeah, absolutely. And so it does really make an impact then, John.
It sure does. And in ways that we are just beginning to figure out how inefficient the system is, and the warning with all these people like Jan who are providing extremely important and relevant and timely information, we need to figure out how to make that stream of information to weather service people and so on more efficient. But we're working on it. So it's really exciting.
We've been seeing a lot, of course, on the on D-Day, because June 6th was the 76th anniversary of D-Day, which weather forecasts actually played a huge role. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, they did play an enormous role. I wrote a biography of one of the people involved in that, but not in a central way, Reginald Sutcliffe, and that'll be coming out in February. So maybe I'll get a chance to talk more about that another time. But one of the things that was fascinating about the D-Day invasion was that the mobilization days before the invasion occurred on the 6th, that was originally scheduled for the 5th, was 4 or 5 days. They had much of the British fleet, the Allied fleet, was up in northern Scotland, staying out of the view of the Germans. And there's no shortcut from northern Scotland to the English Channel. So you have to start days before if you want to ferry and get there at the right time. So the forecasting exercises that the Allies went through from February until June of 1944 were extraordinary in the way that they presaged what we can do now. And they had none of the actual skill in forecasting that we do now, none of the numerical guidance, none of the real observational guidance, except for surface observations. It's a testament to how intelligent the individuals involved in it really were, how good they were at analyzing subtleties in observational data, and how lucky we were that it ended up turning out the way it did. In fact, President Kennedy, I think, asked President Eisenhower as he drove to the Capitol on his inauguration day, how did the invasion work? And Eisenhower said, we had better meteorologists than the Germans. That was his answer.
Yeah, and I think we relied on many different sources, whereas the Germans relied on just kind of one source. And so putting it all together, I think we did a much better job than the Germans, who just relied on one source for weather.
Yeah, and there was an awful lot of strategic and materiel and lives spent making sure that the North Atlantic was observed by the Allies after 1942. And Iceland was occupied and so on. And the Germans knew it was important, but they could not beat us up in that part of the world. And that made a huge difference come June 1944.
Well, come the last Monday of July, we'll be seeing you guys again, I hope.
Yeah.
Yep. We're planning on it, maybe calling in again instead of face-to-face. But
yeah, one way or the other, we'll get back together. Thanks so much, John and Steve. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you, Larry.
Thank you, Larry.
John Martin and Steve Ackerman, both with the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences, and, of course, Steve Ackerman, Vice Chancellor for Research and Graduate Education at UW-Madison, our guest. They'll be back the last Monday of next month. Tomorrow we'll be talking about summer birding. What birds have you been happy to see lately? Love to hear from you tomorrow. And, of course, check out our new blog. Got lots of good information at wpr.org/Larry. Go there to see what's there. Thank you so much for listening, and please do stay with us. Lots more in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.